We were hesitant tonight to take our panelists away from their homemaking. But we felt that they were entitled to a ladies' night out. We have this evening with us a very distinguished guest, Mrs. Alma Lutz, one of the pioneer workers in the fight for women's rights. And the vote, yes, most important, the vote. Our panel tonight is composed of three charming ladies, Dr. Mary Bunting, Mrs. Betty Friedan, and Ms. Pauli Murray. It is my understanding that they will discuss what women's role in this, the great society, should be. Under Dr. Bunting's administration, Radcliffe has undertaken a program of continuing education whose purpose is to encourage women to resume and progress in their professional development. Mrs. Friedan has been in the forefront of encouraging feminine fulfillment through serious professional and volunteer work. We only hope that after our 3 years of eating at Harkness, she has not taken women out of the kitchen forever. Miss Pauli Murray is also in the forefront of a revolutionary movement which threatens to bring the 20th century to women in Alabama. It was no easy task getting a moderator for this program. The forum made a careful and meticulous survey of the entire faculty and could find only two professors who admitted that they understood women. One of them is here tonight, Professor Albert M. Sachs. The other one is home planning Ladies' Day for the spring semester. Professor Sachs was president of the Harvard Law Review and received his LLB in 1948, magna cum laude. He clerked for the late Second Circuit Court Judge Augustus N. Hand in 1948 and 49, and in the following year for Mr. Justice Frankfurter. Professor Sachs was associated with the Washington, D.C. firm of Covington and Burling from 1950 to 1952 before returning to Harvard. He was the director of the Massachusetts Administrative Procedure Study in 1953 and 54, and is currently associate reporter to the Advisory Committee for the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Professor Sachs and Professor Hart have written that favorite of all second-year law students, The Legal Process. I give you Professor Sachs.
You'll notice that I was handled by Mr. Doctors with kid gloves. First of all, he carefully distinguishes me as being in a category separate from the panel. That's one thing. And I had thought before I heard him that my function here, at least one of my functions, was to integrate the group. But now I see that I'm here on largely a token basis, with very little to do. One thing that I will do, I will avoid any facetious humor. That's all too easy. The second thing I will do is to see if I can help you and myself to understand what we're doing this evening. The forum presents something called Dare We Not Discriminate? And it has asked this distinguished panel that question. And when I first considered my role as moderator, I thought, what is the panel going to talk about? And I asked, who is the we? Dare we not discriminate? Of course, the we turns out to be men. I think. but it's a panel of ladies. And so I decided that perhaps what was done was simply to give a perfect example of the male blindness of it all. We means everybody who matters, namely the men. And presumably, you know who they are in all cases. Since there are no ladies, since there are no men on the panel, to answer this question, since there are no men on this panel to answer the question, I thought I would take care of the title by answering it immediately. The answer is, yes, we dare not to discriminate. Provided. Provided. And the provided is the important thing. Because I suppose that both men and women have questions to ask about this topic. They are prepared to face up to it if they get some help and some understanding. For the moment, I would only put a couple of questions. I have no doubt that in this present state of constitutional and statutory law, this problem is and will continue to be a problem of law. But I take it, it is also a problem of the reshaping of women's goals, and I suppose it's a problem of their developing their capacities to realize such new goals. We have a panel remarkably well equipped and very well balanced to deal with all of these questions. There is a fourth question, which I think I have, which relates to my feeling that above all, not much will happen in the field of women's rights and women's place in this society until there's a really great welling up of female indignation. And all I can say is I have seen very little of that female indignation. Perhaps we will see some tonight. It's possible. I, for one, will welcome it. My remaining function, apart from that of policing any obstreperous or recalcitrant people later, is to introduce the panelists. You have received a pamphlet, I think, that tells you something about each, and therefore I will keep my introductions very short. The first speaker is Mrs. Betty Friedan, who is the author of The Feminine Mystique. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Mrs. Friedan.
I'm suffering slightly from culture shock because I have just returned a few days ago from India, where I've spent the last few weeks on a sudden assignment having to do with the selection of a woman as prime minister of the world's largest democracy. And in this country found that the fact of her being a woman never entered into the rather bitter struggle over the selection of the successor to Shastri. There were those who opposed her nomination and those who were for it. But neither from opponent nor from advocate did the fact of her being a woman affect her desirability, availability as Prime Minister of India. Mrs. Indira Gandhi was chosen Prime Minister of India as a political person and will fail or succeed as a political person. And in India, it only people like me, only the outsiders who came in from the press or television or radio in Britain or Germany or from the U.S., raised the question or seemed to think it was particularly remarkable that a woman should be chosen as prime minister. And my physiological clock, still not regulated, back to U.S. time from Indian time, I am here at Harvard Law School on a panel that says, deliberately, I suppose, dare we not discriminate against women? And, of course, the implication here, true implication, and quite different from the situation in India, a supposedly backward country in respect to the United States, is that we do indeed and have discriminated against women, but that this discrimination is something that is so taken for granted, such a given in our society, that it can hardly be considered morally reprehensible, and that we might timidly, or as a part of a parlor game or for a subject of humor, suggest that we stop it, but not really seriously. And in fact, when discrimination on the basis of sex was added to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act this fall, it was introduced seemingly as a joke by a Southern opponent to the Civil Rights Act, and treated as a joke by Congress, and was in fact added to the Civil Rights Act only because, probably much to their own amazement, the few women members of the House suddenly didn't think it was that much of a joke. There is too much human rights feeling in America now for us to tolerate any longer discrimination against women. And I would propose, in opening this discussion, merely to throw out what I think is involved in this question of discrimination against women. Women are the majority of this country, slightly over 50%. They are and have been treated like a deprived minority, with less self-respect than other deprived minorities at this time. For women, in their category as people, are hardly free and equal in this country if the only world they yet freely move in is the traditional world, the traditional woman's world of home, kitchen, bedroom, children, church, and a little auxiliary chauffeuring in the suburbs. Nor are they free and equal, though they have on paper and according to law almost all the rights enjoyed by others, but do not dare to use those rights because of custom, of that congruence of prejudice, half-truths, myths, and other influences to which I gave the name feminine mystique, that tells them they would be unfeminine, somehow jeopardizing their motherhood, their ability to marry or be good wives, their feminine fulfillment, if they chose seriously to use their rights and opportunities and take a full decision-making place as people in this society. Are women truly free and equal, then, if they are forced to make a choice that no man or boy is ever forced to make? That is, somehow implicitly to choose between the desired fulfillments of marriage and family and the full development and realization of whatever potential ability is in them in some serious commitment to society. Whether they make that choice because they've been brainwashed by what I call the feminine mystique, or whether they make it because these images that bombard them from the television commercials and the magazines, and even in more sophisticated forms in the school and the popularized psychoanalytic thinking, all the different influences that impinge upon them, they think somehow that their only destiny, their only future, is to get a man, and all energies must be devoted to that end, beginning before they reach their teens, and surely desirable to marry, or at least be assured of marriage, before 18 or 19, and the majority do marry now, the majority of girls before 20, though in the emerging nations, child marriage is considered as the evil as it is, preventing the development of women to full maturity. If the little girls think that their only possible future and goal is to be a wife and a mother, lifelong, full-time, and therefore get the man as quickly as possible, have the babies as quickly as possible, 3 and 4 children by the time they are 25, and then wake up too late to the simple fact of perhaps another 50, 60, 70 years to live, and no plan to live it when the youngest goes off to school. Or whether girls today make such a choice with some basis of realism, because in all the large world beyond the home, whether it is the world of science or higher education, of industry or government, the patterns are so strictly defined in terms of man's world that there are no existing institutions that make it very easy for a woman in those crucial childbearing years, which, though they may not any longer be a large proportion of women's life, still are a very important portion, no very easy way to combine motherhood responsibly with serious commitment to the kind of profession or political, artistic, or scientific vocation which would use the educated abilities of the women, for instance, who sit here tonight. And women are not really, are they, very free or equal if the only image we have of fulfillment of a woman is that young romantic image, you know, the woman with the wedding veil, or whose husband will take her, if she uses the right soap powder in the machine, will take her dancing forever and make her feel like she's forever 18, or this is forever the wedding night. And the woman must fight old age continually. Well, one might have said at one point after 40, and then one might have said after 30, but with the fashions geared as they are today, one might say that a woman has to fight old age after about 14, you know. So we have no image of mature human fulfillment for a woman. And our late President Kennedy, the tragedy of his assassination in his mid-40s, we all felt so bitterly, was that he was struck down just as he was beginning to move into his full powers, his full human powers. And this was the tragedy, that at 47, just beginning to show what he could be, he was killed. At 47, a woman feels, most American women today, as if she's just, most of them, marking time, you know, getting rid of the time somehow, tranquilizing it away, because there is nothing to look forward to, and she has no real place in society, except, in most cases, some occupational therapy, busy work, and volunteer work, which, good as it may be, is not is something that no one takes quite seriously. Yes, a third of American women work outside the home, most of them as secretaries, selling in department stores, in the menial housekeeping jobs of industry, which are soon to be replaced by automation. And no one thinks it at all wrong, really, if a girl of enormous potential ability gives up her own education after high school, in the middle of college, or after her BA, gives up a Fulbright, gives up, doesn't even take seriously enough to formulate plans for her future use of her ability in order to take a job as a secretary to put her husband through law school. For his future is the important one. Hers, she will be his wife. discrimination against women is involved in all of these things. In the absence of pattern, in the absence of image, and in, but to much lesser degree, overt discriminations that remain, which we do not even recognize as problems to be solved. It was a joke, after all, to introduce sex into the Civil Rights Act. Discrimination against women is a joke to be treated in play to terms like, can one hire a boy to be a playgirl bunny, you know? Is this what will happen if we really try to enforce this? And ha, 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 we won't try to enforce it, like prohibition, you know, a law that nobody will take seriously. The enemy of women today in this country, however, is not men. At least I don't think so. I think that men are fellow victims of the denigration of women implied here, of the generations of denigration of women that is now implicit in women's own denigration of themselves. When a woman is told to make marriage all of life, in a time and a place where no man can possibly expect to make marriage all of life, that woman is by definition going to demand so much of marriage that she is going to find the man inadequate. And this will place an enormous burden on the man to make up to a woman for a whole life, when he has also to bear the burdens of the larger life beyond the home that is a complex responsibility in our society for any man and supposedly for any woman, except that she is not supposed to share it. Man is a fellow victim of the feminine mystique. Man is a fellow victim of this denigration of women, and you only need to see this by listening to the jokes of the comedians, looking at the plays on Broadway, seeing the sense of the enormous hostility between the sexes that is growing in America. We seem to have taken very seriously in recent years the idea of, you know, 88 ways to make your marriage happier, to make your sex life happier, and every woman has read ad nauseam, you know, can this marriage be saved? And it has spawned a whole professions of people who are trying to help her save her marriage. It's, of course, always the woman who must save the marriage, and the next step, the mental health clinic, it's the woman, the mother, that is at fault for the neuroses and problems of the child. And with all the stress on being a better wife, being a better mother, all that seems to happen is that we discover more and more children who are mentally ill, and we find marriage in a worse and worse state. And it is enough, there's merely enough for any comic on television to say, "My wife," for the audience to know immediately that a laugh is called for. The wife as the hostile butt of jokes in America is a phenomenon that, for instance, people from Scandinavian countries, to say nothing of people from the Far East, find strange. Evidently, in other cultures, the wife is not automatically the butt of a joke. The assumption of this enormous hostility against the wife is not there. And in converse, the family situation comedies, where the plot is not exactly family love, but family, well, revenge or hate, and the main motif is that the woman, who is usually a very silly little boob, will get the better of the man who is an even sillier boob, you know. This is the enduring theme. The enemy of women today, however, the perpetuator, in a sense, of discrimination against women is women, because the denigration involved, the denigration of woman as a person, able to face the problems of a complex time and use her abilities and opportunities with the highest kind of commitment that will speak to her in this time, what keeps her from doing this above all is dependencies, fears, inhibitions in her own mind. I do not think the overt barriers are that great, but they are there. I think that if women themselves aspired higher, took on the problems involved, that they might find surprising support from men. I think men have been brainwashed the same way women have on this subject, and furthermore, that the hostilities built up in men against women by too many years of too much mother, too much wife, too much demand on marriage, can find as a scapegoat the thought of any woman at all, and I have too much of them at home, for heaven's sakes, not in the office too, you know, and not in the Harvard Club, except behind the door somewhere, but even the Harvard Club of New York is having a discussion this year on the status of women, you know. Time marches on, and in an era of civil rights, someone suddenly realized that women are going to be the last ones standing outside the gate. The gate of our whole society, which at this point stretches much further than the narrow walls of the split-level house, the ranch house, or even the elegant, restored Victorian or colonial house, stretches far beyond the walls of a single home. And for a woman to truncate herself, to truncate a lifespan, which if for me now comes close to 80 years, for my daughter will surely be 100 years, in which motherhood can be at most a minor portion of that life. And yet we still encourage, permit, and see nothing wrong with the daughters patterning a whole life on the basis that motherhood will define it. And yet, if we are going to address ourselves to the question, dare we not discriminate against women, we must address ourselves to the fact that if we dare end discrimination against women, which means if we dare finally take women seriously as people and intend to use their abilities seriously outside the home in every area of society in which women's human potential, human mind can be of use, in an era when automation and the machine are fast replacing our automatic routinized tasks, the muscle power and the brain power we know women share with men, if we are going to think seriously of using this and of giving women a fruitful lives and fruitful maturity for a good portion of that 100-year lifespan, we must also take them seriously as women. For it is a form of discrimination against women not only to segregate them to the home and forbid them either by overt discrimination or by practice, custom, simple prejudice, forbid them from entering the decision-making areas of society. How many women, in fact, do sit on the Supreme Court, in the Senate, in the governor's mansions, in the state legislatures, in Congress? How many women full professors at Harvard? How many women presidents of college? How many women, even today, principals of schools, even of elementary schools, which used to be considered a woman's profession, declining women in all the decision-making areas outside the home? But if we are to surmount this, it surely cannot mean that only a few exceptional women who will be willing to give up their attributes as women to enter man's world as freaks or exceptions will find an open door. There must be new patterns introduced into professions previously defined as man's world that will take into account that one difference, the childbearing nature of women, which does coincide in time with crucial training years in professions like law and medicine, or crucial early years of practice. And we cannot extrapolate into the future patterns that have happened by chance and as a result of cultural lag in the present. The pattern, for instance, that so many women of my generation followed of, yes, having education equal to man's in college, perhaps working a few years afterwards, and then taking out 10, 15, 20 years, having children, thinking that one could live according to that lovely housewife image for the rest of one life, and then waking up at 40 to the need to do something for the rest of one's life. But 10, 15, 20 years out of a science or of any profession, too much has happened. Too much has moved on in the field. Too much has been lost in the self-confidence of the woman to move in anywhere near equal step to her own potential, to the demand she could otherwise fulfill in the society, anywhere near equality with man. And yet, it is not impossible to devise slightly different timing patterns for women, which will permit them also to mesh the new dimension of human years, the new dimension of life in society that the new years of life give them with their traditional dimensions of wife, mother, homemaker. One can find a few far-seeing hospitals in Boston and New York which permit women now to take their training in residency training in pediatrics or psychiatry on a slightly different timing pattern than the men do, not 24 hours a day in the hospital, because these women will be having children if they are mothers during the time of their residency. When Mrs. Dunning was in Washington, the Atomic Energy Commission started what I consider a breakthrough pattern, using women on a part-time basis for scientific work, though the civil service rules seem to prohibit this utterly. A far-seeing personnel man saw that there was nothing impossible in introducing a new pattern to use very able women on a part-time basis for a few years, and then when they were able to bring them in on a full-time basis. After all, in the Atomic Energy Commission, there's had to be innovations from the beginning. The American spirit is open to such innovations. There is an urgency to this question, dare we not discriminate, that the timidity of its wording does not imply. For I suggest that if we do not stop discriminating against women now, if we do not introduce the new patterns now and face the problems that remain to be solved now to permit women to move in society, in decision-making ways in society, in equal ranks with men, and to use their rights and opportunities, the door that's open now may well be closed. There are, I understand, perhaps 5% of the students here at Harvard Law who are women. It's not a very high percentage. There are, in the colleges, a third of the seats now occupied by girls. I would suggest that the voices and the mutterings now heard behind the scenes will get louder with the pressures for higher education on anyone who expects to take a role in the society of the future, the society of automation, doing all the menial work, that there will not be a tolerance much longer for girls to use these valuable seats if girls are not going to use the education in society. I suggest also that the kinds of attitudes that, if I speak only, speaking as I am to an educated audience, in terms of the education person, the urgencies that automation poses for the educated, the problems become even more severe if we look on a wider spectrum of society, face as we do the tragedy of the high school dropout, for instance, setting up projects all over the country to deal with the dropout, knowing that he must be somehow motivated to train himself for a future role in society, if he is a boy. But the projects for high school dropouts for a girl are minimal. For the girl, we'll marry and have children, and that's all we need to think of about her. And yet, in that rank of society, as in any other rank, the necessity for a girl to aspire to some use of her life rather than the mere production of children, as important as the production of children may be, is necessary. With the population explosion, it really isn't very desirable any longer for educated girls, much less uneducated girls, to say, I'm going to devote my life to producing children. The 5- and 6-child family may have been fashionable in the post-war years. It may be morally reprehensible in the future. There is an urgency also in terms of, if we wish to restore a decent relationship between the sexes, if we wish, for instance, heterosexual love to survive, if we don't want to succumb to a concept of sex that finds only homosexuality a viable thing, which one could gather from certain trends in theater and literature today, one must do something to end the war between the sexes. And I suggest that this is only really going to end when women are permitted to use their energies on a larger scale instead of turning them in against themselves and on the men with whom they share, the confinement after the man comes home from work. And finally, I suggest that we had better stop discriminating against women and let them grow to their full stature as people if we want to raise children who are going to be able to cope seriously with the adult problems of our society today, rather than to have a whole generations of educated women put all their energies on living through their children and making it a child-centered society, begin to educate whole generations of women to put their energies on the adult problems of society and, yes, to raise children who will also be able to grow seriously to mature adult commitments in society. I think that the only way to stop this discrimination against women is, however, to begin with women. I don't think we can expect men, out of some largesse, to conceive of patterns, conceive of patterns that really only women will be able to conceive of. I think it is necessary for women to get into City Hall to make the changes that are necessary. I think it is necessary, in effect, for women to do what the Negro has done. But the Negro had his rights on paper 100 years ago. It was only in the relatively last few years when young Negroes first and then older ones began to take themselves seriously and in self-respect decided that they would no longer travel, walk, eat, buy in shops, buy houses, send their children to school, or even go to the toilet with less than full human dignity and equality as Americans, as citizens, that society took them seriously. And then we began to have Supreme Court decisions, and then we began to have changes in law. I don't think that law will begin any of this. I think it has already begun in the minds of women and men, a consciousness that is the prelude to any new step in a revolution, and this kind of session is a part of this growing consciousness. But I think that when it does begin, as far-thinking, pace-setting lawyers, you will be able to conceive of new ways to legally outlaw a kind of discrimination that is much less simple, less easy to observe and outlaw than the discrimination against the Negro. And I think that this would be a worthy task for Americans who are in the battle for enlarged human freedoms for the coming decades.
next speaker has had a very distinguished career in American higher education, recently took a year's leave of absence from her present job to serve as a commissioner on the Atomic Energy Commission, is now back in Cambridge at the work she has been doing for quite a while as president of Radcliffe, someone whom a good many of you know quite well. It's my pleasure to present Mrs. Mary Bunting.
Friends, I should like to use my few minutes here this evening to give you a kind of progress report on my findings and thoughts in this field, much as I might report on recent experiments in the laboratory. In doing this, I'd like to touch very quickly on and remind a few of you of how my own thinking has developed here, but I'm particularly interested in some new aspects that have impressed me just this year. I'm particularly interested in the fact that the things I'd like to emphasize tonight, the things I'm most interested in, are really quite different from the points I would have emphasized if I'd spoken to you a year ago. Reminding you quickly of this development in my own thinking, I really grew up, went to college, went on to graduate school, believing that this whole problem had been licked long ago, and honestly not very, very interested in it. I wasn't aware of any particular personal problems as I went along. I might question other women's taste in the way they chose to live their lives, but not their freedom to make their decisions, and so forth. As I'm watching the students I talk with this year, I'm suddenly beginning to wonder whether some of the freedom that women earned through the 1940s and 50s when they said no to continuing education, when they said, I want to stay home, whether this wasn't very important, a very important step in what I see now emerging. I'm reminded of the way children grow up, you know, and they go through that phase when they say yes to every question you ask them, and then and a few months later they say no to every question you ask them, and then they seem to be free to say yes or no. And I wonder whether something of the same process may not have had to happen culturally. I don't know anything about this. My own interest in the problem was aroused post-Sputnik, when we came to realize, as we were, some of us were thinking about, more scientific brain power, and wondering what was happening to identified brain power, when we discovered that of the identified bright young people in high school, and we didn't worry so much at that time about the ones who didn't show up because they hadn't had a chance. But in terms of the identified ones, you know, in the top 10% by ability tests, when we discovered that more than 95%, maybe 98-99% of those who did not go on to college were females, that one startled me and aroused my interest in this whole problem. And the clue, as I looked on this, came from the fact that the government tried to suppress this statistic, that this was censored, really. And this led me to think that America really didn't believe it would make any importance in that difference. That as long as all the bright young men were going on, you know, everything was okay. That there really was a climate, what I called a climate of unexpectation, as to what women would do with their talents and education. And that very likely this was the key, because the thing that worried me, you see, was what, you know, why weren't these girls going on? There was the manpower problem, but more important in my view was the fact that they were missing so much, and why weren't they going on? And so my hypothesis, and it's a very crude hypothesis, was that this climate dissuaded them, that it got in the way of their motivation, that it also got in the way of the motivation of educational institutions, so that they didn't really try awfully hard to do anything about this. And I began to see that even the women's colleges were awfully interested in training them up to the bachelor's degree, but you know, not awfully concerned with what you needed to do beyond then. That the women's colleges were the slowest about admitting a married woman or a part-time one, and so forth, that they weren't awfully interested. Well, this was a pretty useful hypothesis, and an awful lot of things seemed to fall into place, like the way people talk to little children, and this business about the women's colleges, and lack of research on what you're doing about this whole half of the population, and some of the exceptions fell in line, too. So I started, you know, trying to do little experiments, getting them to Douglas College to admit the women part-time in the city who wanted to go on to get their degrees, and a number of other experiments, one of the larger ones being the Radcliffe Institute, to try to in that case to really show, you know, do something to change the climate a little bit. To indicate that we really did value what those women who happened to get educated and happened to be motivated might want to do with it, you know, and maybe if Radcliffe valued it, someone else would, and so forth. Well, so much for background. Now, just a few minutes on the rather dramatic change that I believe is taking place now. In the way young women are planning their lives. I don't know whether I'm more impressed as I grow older with how hard it is to make changes or how easy. You can argue either side of this. I don't think it's the things that have happened, at Radcliffe or Minnesota or any other place, that has affected this change half so much. Civil rights, Phillips Brooks House, the look we've begun to take at some of the things that need to be done in our society. In any event, I think that today the young women whom I'm talking with assume, as they have for a long time, that they want to get married, that they want to have families, that they want to give considerable time to this, but I find now that they are absolutely assuming also that there's some important job they want to do way on down the line, and that it's going to take a lot of preparation to get ready for this. Whereas once it looked so far down the line that there was a little feeling of why bother, that now it looks so far down the line that they have the feeling we got plenty of time to really get ready. And this kind of planning is going on. Let me give you just one example. I could give you any number from recent conversation. One of my early ones was a girl who said, yeah, I'm heading for hospital management. I'm concentrating in economics here now. I'm expecting to go to medical school. I'll read sociology and things like that when the children are little. Maybe the books will be better by then. I'll be ready eventually to do a job in hospital management. Well, this is the kind of talking I'm beginning to hear all around, and I think it's quite different. I don't hear much worry about whether the education they're getting in college is relevant to their later life. I think that's just gone out on the whole. And this isn't, I don't think this is just a Radcliffe phenomenon. I talked about this in Texas a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of the girls came up to me afterward and they said, that's exactly what we think. We hadn't realized it, but that's exactly the way we feel. It's not an awfully competitive sort of thing in a way. They're not talking hard about, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer or I'm going to be a doctor, but I'm going to work on hospital management, I'm going to work on urban development, I'm going to get this training on the way. Very serious interest in getting ready. As one girl said the other night when a group came in, one of them said, yeah, we're all going to fix something, Mrs. Bundy. And I said, for instance, and they went around the room and they knew what they were going to fix. There's also the feeling that some of them mentioned that women have some very special advantages. As one of them said, the pattern of a woman's life, you know, this lingo, may be a handicap in the rat race for position, but for what I want to do, it might be a distinct advantage. Or as another one who's planning to go into surgery, hospital surgery, said, you know, a woman doesn't need to worry that much about money. Either I get married and I won't need too much to earn too much myself, or I won't get married and I don't need to earn too much. You know, there's a kind of serenity about this. Well, the real point I'd like to make, and I'm trying to make this wherever I can, to the people who may ought to be getting ready, is that we've got a great many young women in America now who are motivated to go on. That the bottleneck now is going to be at the graduate and professional level. And that the real question now is about the motivation of our graduate and professional schools. There are going to be two things needed, because these young women are not going to postpone marriage or children, perhaps, indefinitely to get this long education that they want. There are going to be two things needed, and one is the flexibility that was mentioned. They're going to need some of them to break for a while, or to take it part-time for a while and so forth. The other thing that they're going to need is money. I think there's no question about this. One of the studies we're starting now at the Radcliffe Institute is a study of the educational background and aspirations of the wives of graduate students in the Boston area. There are thousands of them. And I think to get this story and see this picture, here are these thousands tied into our universities and fenced out. In so many cases. And right at the moment when geographically they, and in terms of time they could be going on, so many are kept out, and I suspect that one of the big reasons will turn out to be financial. So that there's going to be a new pressure on this whole thing resulting from the point of view of these young women. I think a tenth of them from Radcliffe this year at least are planning to go to medical school, more than a tenth are planning to go to law school, and so forth and so on. And I think that our graduate and professional schools now have really got to wake up to a different kind of challenge, and that it's going to be very interesting to watch it. Thank you.
The Harvard Law School quinquennial contains the names of all Harvard Law School graduates with the LLB, the LLM, the SJD, all persons who flunked out of Harvard Law School, all persons who attended Harvard Law School and didn't flunk out of the school, didn't get any degrees, does not have the name of Miss Pauli Murray. Though I think after she finishes telling you of her experience, you will agree with me it probably should be there. But she'll tell you about that. She is a lawyer. She has just recently been a senior tutor at Yale Law School after a law work at Howard and at Berkeley and at Yale. She has been a practitioner, a government lawyer. I don't have any doubt that you are going to enjoy listening to her, as I have for just a short time before the session began. Miss Pauli Murray.
Friends, I'm glad to be here. It's true that I'm 22 years late. It is also true that I would have paid any money to be here tonight. And thereby hangs a tale. Most of us have been very concerned in recent years about dropouts. But nobody seems to have been concerned about a drop-in. Your president tonight looked over the biographical sketches and he said, gee, you certainly have degrees from coast to coast. And I didn't answer him. I will answer him now. It was not necessary for me to go to coast to coast. I could have settled it all at Harvard 2 years ago, 22 years ago. In 2 years. Harvard inadvertently granted me 2 degrees, the Bachelor of Feminism in 1944 and the Master's of Feminism in 1946. And I am here tonight to take my oral examination in the doctorate of feminism, but I am not sure that I see my inquisitors. In 1944, I finished Howard Law School, top of my class. Now, don't get excited. As you know, top of your class simply means that it's good on paper and you have a better chance of getting a job. And it wasn't difficult to do it in 1944 because the Army had all the competition and the opposition. But nevertheless, the top man in my class wore skirts. Moreover, won a Rosenwald Fellowship, which specified for graduate work at Harvard. All the men in my class and the professors in the school, most of whom were Harvard graduates, held degrees and graduate degrees from Harvard, laughed in derision. I have never been known to lay down on a dare, so I forthwith applied to Harvard. And we went through the regular procedure of getting the undergraduate transcript. They asked for a picture. So I sent them one of my little pictures, and I wrote to Hunter College and said, send them up a manuscript. Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Mr. T.R. Powell. I think he is dead now, and I guess he is. It was before your time. Mr. T.R. Powell was the chairman of the graduate committee. He wrote back and said, dear Miss Murray, the salutation on your undergraduate transcript, at that time Hunter College was all women, and your picture indicate that you are not of the sex entitled to be admitted into Harvard. I have an excellent memory. That is practically photogenic. Well, it is said that a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client. I was a brash young law school graduate, and I was my first client. So I promptly appealed to the Board of Overseers and indicated that I wished to go to Harvard Law School. And meanwhile, the president, Mr. Roosevelt, in the White House, was a distinguished alumnus or alumni of Harvard. And in those days, when we didn't like anything, we always wrote the president. So I wrote the president. But I tried to beat the system, so I also wrote Mrs. Roosevelt and sent her a copy. And knowing that Mrs. Roosevelt was a real feminist at heart, I said, someday when you have a chance, will you slip this to the president? I didn't trust the male side of the ladder, you see. And I thought my letter would get lost in, in Secretary 16's pigeonhole. Well, sure enough, Mrs. Roosevelt did pass the letter on to Mr. Roosevelt, and he got a great kick out of it. Because I said, you know, Mr. Roosevelt, you're a distinguished alumnus of this school, and you know that this is where people go and get the prestige degrees, and they become judges, and they become presidents, and whatnot. And women who are lawyers want the same opportunity. And Mr. Roosevelt, FDR Sr., was, in a sense, a feminist. He was never threatened by women. He, I think, appointed the first cabinet member, woman cabinet member, Secretary Perkins. So he wrote a very genial and amusing letter to President Connah and said, there's a young woman who wants to get into Harvard. And President Connah must have looked up the record. And then he got very, very excited because he thought, oh my, they'll think that we are discriminating on the basis of race and we can't have Harvard's reputation impeached like that. And so President Connah hurriedly wrote back to President Roosevelt and said, why, of course we don't discriminate on the basis of race. Why, of course Miss Murray can come to Radcliffe, and I am having my secretary send all the Radcliffe catalogs. The only thing, Radcliffe didn't give a master's degree in law. At which point, the Board of Overseers, or the Board of Governors, whatever the governing body of Harvard is, met. And they decided they had nothing to decide upon because they had received no recommendation from the faculty. You can see that I was just out of law school and had not anticipated that move. They forthwith informed me that they had made no decision because there was no motion or recommendation before them. I then reapplied to the faculty, having been a good law student, and I said, will you please ask the faculty to recommend to the Board of Governors that I be admitted to Harvard Law School? Meanwhile, all of the members of the Board of Governors who I knew personally, one of Lloyd K. Garrison, who was one of the members at that time, said, Pauly, you haven't got a chance. Harvard has been that way 3,300 years, and it isn't likely ever to change. I, however, didn't know that. I was quite ignorant of tradition and how important tradition is. The faculty met again, but also anticipating that they were going to reject me. The only other school in the country that had a full-time faculty of the masters in those days, and in those days you would go to a university because it had certain professors. The only other law school in the country was the University of California, which had all of the sort of the almost retiring products of Harvard University. So that's where I wound up, on the other coast. When I arrived to register at the University of California, they said, oh, you're that girl who split the Harvard faculty 7-7 on your application to enter. I had only wished there had been an eighth one. And he was on my side, because this would have saved me 3,000 miles in 2 years, but nevertheless, there it was. The graduate degree was gotten at California. I returned east, And it was then I learned that Harvard had taken a giant step. They had appointed Soya Menshnikoff, first woman faculty member. I thought, oh, this is wonderful. It's a chance for us students. So I forthwith reapplied. Dean Griswold in those days was chairman of the graduate committee. And Dean Griswold wrote back in very solemn tones. And he said, our full-time faculty has not yet returned from their war assignments, and we have returning veterans. And we cannot consider the question of women until we have dealt with the question of returning veterans. 3 years later, I read in the newspaper that Harvard Law School had voted to admit women. But by this time, all my scholarship funds were gone, and it wasn't possible for me to go to graduate school. So this is how I got the Bachelor of Feminism degree. It should be clear by now that from the three speakers in the platform, the word women as a stereotype should be dispensed with. I seriously doubt whether there are three individuals who could approach this problem from more diverse points of view than the three individuals that you have here. Let me start my remarks, and I want to be very careful because I see we're running quite late, and so I will be brief and you can get at me in the discussion. I want to throw out for your consideration some thoughts that were advanced last year at a panel discussion at the University of California Medical Center called the Biologic Avalanche Challenge to Women. And this had to do with the population explosion that we are facing worldwide as well as the United States. And what did this mean in terms of its challenge to women? What role would women play either in preventing this avalanche or slowing it down? What did it mean in terms of world problems, social, political, economic, and otherwise? One of the panelists was Dr. Mira Komorowski, head of the sociology department at Barnett. She made what I thought was a very perceptive analysis. She pointed out that 100 years ago, men in America, and I must say at this point, white men, because Negro men hardly figured into the picture, had exclusive privileges, by and large, for education. The exclusive right to vote and the political power. And therefore, it was very logical and very natural that they should excel in all of the significant areas of public life and private industry and enterprise. That 100 years later, we've been faced with a technological revolution and a human rights revolution. And unless you consider these rumblings from the feminine side of the nation, in the context of the human rights revolution, of which the Negro Revolution is a very noisy and more articulate part at this moment, unless you see this in a context of world revolution, you will continue to make jokes about it and to laugh and to talk about women. But it is very, very serious business, and let us not kid ourselves. Dr. Komorowski pointed out that in this era of exclusive power and privilege and right to education, she suspected that men had equated supremacy and superior status with masculinity. And they had confused the two concepts. That 100 years later, with a technological revolution and with the world revolution in human rights. This status, privilege, and power was being challenged. And having identified it with masculinity, the challenge to the privilege and the power seemed, in fact, to be a challenge to masculinity, and that in this lies much of the confusion about women's rights, individuality, and whatnot. This analysis deeply impressed me. I throw it out to you for what it is worth. I want to talk a little bit about women's rights as citizens. And I want you again to keep it into this larger context. 40 years ago, women won the vote. 46 years, I guess, ago, won the vote. And they thought that they were citizens. They thought they had full political rights. Here in the great liberal state of Massachusetts, the cradle of liberty and abolitionism, Crispus Attucks, the Boston Common, Paul Revere, a woman was arrested on a minor criminal charge and tried and convicted by an all-male jury. And she immediately appealed the conviction on the ground that she had not been charged, convicted, or tried before a jury of her peers, i.e., a jury on which women were represented. This obviously was a violation of the 14th Amendment. She had all of the precedent she needed. She had a whole line of Negro cases, which had shown that where Negroes are systematically excluded from juries, this is a violation of their rights under the Equal Protection. And the majestic Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts ruled that even though the 19th Amendment was now passed, and even though the qualifications for jurors under the Massachusetts law said all persons who are qualified electors shall be jurors, it was not a violation of the 14th Amendment for women still to be excluded from jury service in the state of Massachusetts. Now let me take you to the ultimate and logical result of that ruling. The Supreme Court ducked the issue. It refused certification of the case and did not review it. This then appeared to remain the law of the land, and the great and doughty warriors of woman suffrage who had fought and gone to jail and carried on demonstrations, not unlike the demonstrations we have witnessed in the last 3 years, felt that they had been deemed by the court not to be persons within the meaning of the Constitution of the United States, that there was a constitutional gap, and that the only way that women could be recognized as full citizens was to have an Equal Rights Amendment. And they fought for the next 40 years to get this Equal Rights Amendment. And while they were fighting, the states did various things with jury laws. Some admitted women as jurors. Some gave women blanket exemptions. Some made women go down to the courthouse and register their desire to serve as jurors before they would be put on the jury list. And three states, Alabama, Mississippi, and South Carolina, by statute excluded women altogether. It is not surprising that these were three southern states in which we have had many of our problems in race relations. It is no historical accident that of the 10 states in the country which refused to ratify the 19th Amendment, the Equal Suffrage Amendment, only one of them, Delaware, was above the Mason and Dixon line. The other were the nine states, were the nine of the former slaveholding states. And if you will check your annotated constitution, Corwin's edition, 1952, you will find that seven of those nine actually voted to reject the Equal Suffrage Amendment. In 1955 to 1965, there have been 89 race-related deaths by violence growing out of the Civil Rights Revolution and crisis in the South. Of those 89, summarized by the Southern Regional Council, so far as we have been able to determine, there have been only 6 convictions. The 2 acquittals, which probably sent us all into shock last midsummer, were the acquittal of the accused slayer of Mrs. Viola Liuzzo, followed immediately by the acquittal of the accused slayer of the young Episcopal seminarian from New Hampshire. Both either acquitted or by a hung jury by all white, all male jurors. And we found from the Department of Justice experience that where there had been women on those Southern juries, the Department of Justice had increased its chances of getting a conscientious and impartial trial. So let no one say that that case that we just won in Alabama, and I was one of the 5 lawyers on the brief, Judge Dorothy Kenyon was the 2nd, and we were the ones who wrote the sex discrimination argument, and the court came right down the line, actually using our language. I would say that after so many losses and so many failures and so many defeats in a lifetime, this was my sweetest victory today. Our concern was not nearly so much the rights of women, although those by themselves would have been sufficient, and we would not have had to apologize for them. But we are trying to find an alternative to the turmoil and the anarchy in the South. And if we are to have law and order in these states, particularly in South Carolina and particularly in Mississippi and Alabama, and in perhaps a lesser degree in Louisiana, we must have an impartial jury system where Negro civil rights workers and white civil rights workers feel that they will get justice if they themselves are defendants, and where people will feel that if they are, by any horrible chance, murdered or beaten or their civil rights are taken from them, that the Department of Justice can go into those courts and punish the wrongdoers. And we immediately saw that not only were all the Negro males excluded from these juries, but all women. And so in Lowndes County, where these 2 murders took place, and where you got these acquittals by all white, all male juries, when you analyze the population, the adult population between 21 and 65, you found that 84% of the adult population potentially available for jury service were completely excluded, either by administrative practice, i.e. the Negro males, or by statute, all females, white and black, leaving 16% only of the adult population of jury age available for jury duty, and this meant 738 names of white males. Of those 738, only 630 appeared on the jury list, and of those 630, 221 accounted for 66% of all the persons called for jury duty. Some of these 221 appeared 5 and 6 times, and some even as many as 15 and 16 times. And therefore, you had the most unrepresentative type of jury that it is possible to find in a petty jury system in the United States. And those of you who have studied constitutional law know this is in direct contradiction to the modern trend, which is toward a representative jury as a cross-section of the community. The public interest that we have in having such a jury in order to have impartial trials. It is obvious that with me, I have had no choice but to fight for women's rights and to fight for Negroes' rights, And it will very soon be that I will have no choice but to fight for the rights of the aged. I am rapidly qualifying. I am also practically congenitally left-handed, so I'm always to the left in every situation, a little bit askew. And so I had nothing to lose but to want to be an individual. And this is my third and final observation. Nature does not ask us where she distributes brains, intellect, talent, drive. She simply scatters these with the recombination of the genes. In some ways, I might have been disadvantaged to have been born a Negro in white America, a woman in a man's profession, left-handed in a right-handed world, and I might throw in even an orphan at an early age. But there were certain advantages in this status, which I didn't see then, but I see in retrospect. Negroes, as you know, are out of the mainstream of America. And being out of the mainstream, I didn't know there was any such thing as a woman's place. I was out there having a gay old time with complete freedom of thought. My parents were dead. I lived with my grandparents. They were older people. They didn't have time to keep up with what a youngster was doing. And so I had none of the restrictions intellectually that many children are forced into today. I therefore came to sex discrimination much later than I came to race discrimination. And having fought the battle of race discrimination, I began to see how integrally these two discriminations were. Since I could not split myself, and since I had to be a unified human being, I decided that it was not I that was wrong, but the society that was wrong. And that any time a society penalizes an individual because of a biological attribute, whether it be race per se, or whether it be sex per se, that society is going to be challenged. Now, I'm not going to exhort or have any exhortations about what women should do and what the men should let us do. You note that I come out of a struggle of a minority which has now so determined it says either America is going to let us in or we will keep America on its head for the rest of our lives. And this minority has demonstrated its capacity to do it. As a woman, in terms of the legal rights of women as citizens, who have both a right and a responsibility to share the levers of power of this country, I am not going to exhort the men to let us in. And now I speak to the budding members of my profession, the women who are studying law. The Negroes set the stage for a revolution by digging into the law books, burning the midnight hours, coming up with persuasive legal documentation and argument, the sheer logic of which forced a Supreme Court continually to retread its earlier movement. This was not done entirely by Negroes alone. The whole world economic conditions were, and social conditions and social revolutions were playing. But basically, these lawyers in their lonely law offices, many hours at night, were fighting the battle of the law books. And on sheer logic by itself, persuaded those judges to respect their point of view. On February 7th, 1966, when a three-district federal court came down unequivocally and said that the 14th Amendment applies to prejudicial disparities among all citizens, including women, I did not need a Harvard law degree. Thank you.
take it they liked it.
Huh?
I take it they liked it.
The hour is late, and we want to give you an opportunity to ask questions. I think in order to take care of those who want to get home at a reasonable hour, I will simply be arbitrary and limit the question period to not more than 15 minutes under any circumstances. In other words, not later than 10:20. And, of course, if your questions don't come at all, or if you just sort of whimper out before 10:20, then we'll know where you stand on the issue. If there are any people who want to stay after 10:20 and ask questions informally, I have no doubt they will be welcome. And so, my first point is, who would like to start the questioning? I should add that anyone who wishes to ask a question is requested to come to this microphone at the foot of the hall in order that his question may be heard on the tape that's being made of this whole program. He should also state his name and indicate to whom he is addressing his question. Notice my pronouns. Fine.
My name is Mark Finley. I just wondered if there isn't some subtle discrimination going on here right now. I noticed in the program there's a Nancy Sheckman on the Harvard Law School Forum.
You haven't indicated to whom you're addressing the question.
Well, I'm just stating the question first there.
Would you tell us to whom you are addressing the question?
Oh, Samuel Doctor. Samuel Doctor.
All right.
But Nancy Sheckman is listed here, and she has no part in the proceedings. I'd just like to see her. Is she here?
May I exercise simply the moderator's prerogative and ask Ms. Sheckman to please stand up? She arranged the entire program, as I understand, and had a great deal to do with it. Now, may we have a question? Anybody who wants to follow the questioner who is speaking is asked to come forward and indicate by just standing there that they want to ask the next question. Go ahead.
Andrew Newman to Mr. Bent. You all seem to agree that there's a problem, and Ms. Bunton says that the bottleneck is in higher education, and Ms. Murray says that the problem is in law, and I wonder what you want to do about it. I've heard nothing constructive from your point of view. You say that women do things which men do not take seriously, and you mentioned homemaking and volunteer work, being secretaries, etc. And I wonder, should women start doing different things, or should we start taking seriously what they're doing now?
May I answer my part in one word and get it over with?
I don't know whether Mrs. Perdea wants to answer first. I was going to give you each a chance.
Just one word. I have to call the tune on the question, you don't do anything constructive. I have been calling for a sharing of power from the presidency of the United States down to the sheriff. Now, this may be destructive because it will destroy privilege, but in my book, it's constructive.
Well, you see, homemaking isn't ruled out by what I say. The fact of life is that women in America, and with the lifespan they have today, simply cannot, for the most part, use all their abilities or all their years productively only in homemaking. So merely to ask that, and I don't agree with Mrs. Bunning that the problem is all solved. I see declining numbers of women in all the, still, in all the professions, and in all of the professions that are going to exist in the future world, with when the secretaries, for instance, are going to be replaced, and the bookkeepers by and the bank tellers by automation. Most of the jobs women now hold outside the home will be automated out of existence. There is no way for women to use their lives and years productively within the homes, with the home, unless they begin to have, say, 10 and 12 child families, and even then they're going to have half their lives after their childbearing years are over. So they must be able to get the kind of higher education that Mrs. Bunning is talking about, which means very much now in these years professional education, although there will be new professions and occupations emerging. I think to take more seriously what women now do, well, there's been a whole stream of propaganda for 20 years trying to say occupation housewife, we should make it a sacred thing. It requires more ability than to be an atomic scientist, you know, and combination chauffeur, gardener, cook, and all the rest. True, you know, we all do these things, women who have children in homes, whether we're also college presidents or whether we do nothing beyond the dishwashing and the PTA. But I submit that since 50% of the women in America are by definition above average, you know, let's at least, since, and this is probably the proportion that intimately concerns the people here, at least let's use these abilities in the most productive possible way in society. And prejudices have to be erased to do this. Images have to be created, and new patterns in society have to be instituted, whether they're nursery schools and different ideals, for instance, of childbearing, which suppose that the mother's life is as important as the child's, that the mother's time is not to be spent primarily in chauffeuring as the child. The child could ride the bicycle himself, you know, things like that. To part-time patterns in graduate school, and to perhaps, I disagree that we can't counteract this early marriage thing. I certainly think we can counteract too early motherhood. In India, child marriage is seen as the evil it is for the deterrent of the woman's growth. It is equally an evil for a young rascal girl to take so with little seriousness her education. She thinks that she shouldn't plan in terms of her own future. She can put the boy through law school and maybe take up urban development some years later. I've seen those girls some years later. They're very worthy citizens. But the city of Washington is full of ones who would love to do something in urban development, but they cannot meet the professional qualifications to get hired by any of the agencies who deal with urban development. Unless they have rich husbands, they're not very likely to get the professional education at 45 that they didn't get at 25.
Let's see, who was the next person?
I'm Kay Ryan. I'm at the Harvard Law School. I address my question to Mrs. Bunting. It wasn't exactly clear to me what you meant by saying that the graduate and professional schools would have to take a different approach. I'm sure you have rather concrete ideas, and I'd like to have the benefit of them if you would like to expound on them a bit.
Thank you. Just quickly, and first may I say that I don't think the problems are all solved, of course. I just was trying to point out tonight some interesting changes that I think are going on in the way young women are looking ahead. And although I think there is a real shift, certainly among Radcliffe students, in terms of of the age at which they get married. I don't think that they are planning to postpone this beyond the time that they would, let's say, necessarily finish an internship if they go on to medical school. I think that the kind of plan they're making is one of finishing college, and then somewhere along in the next period they expect to get married. And instead of having a big gap later, what they'd like to do is continue their education through along with their family responsibilities, and that this is going to take a new flexibility on the part of our professional schools and graduate education, and a willingness to value this kind of preparation so that they will be ready later, a willingness to help them financially, even though they're working part-time. These two things are going to be essential for this new pattern to develop. And it's this that I have in mind particularly.
There seems to be a trend in the pattern of development, and that is that most of you sort of address yourself to the question of women, their attitude towards their role. And this is bunting to a certain extent as to the new interest of women, this marriage perhaps to some of the legal possibilities. I wonder what your feeling is about changing men's attitudes, which you haven't gone into in any great detail, and whether that is in some way necessary in your overall goal.
Your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Peter Kuboff from the law school.
Well, I haven't ever thought there was any great significance to the ideas of men about these problems or of women about these problems as such. It has seemed to me that as I first got interested in this, that there was a whole climate. And that it affected most men and most women, and that there were exceptions on both sides, and that this thing better be looked at that way rather than talking about men's point of view or women's point of view.
I thought I suggested very clearly how to change people's attitudes. There is nothing so educative than a successful challenge to power. This we all know. We've seen it happen in the Civil Rights Revolution. I was one of the student sit-inners in the 1940s, but all they did to us was just arrest us, carry us off to jail. Nobody knew about it because we had no power. We were a handful, 10 or 12. But when 50,000 Negroes began marching in the streets, Washington heard about it. Then 240,000 citizens came to Washington on August 23rd, 1963, we got a Civil Rights Act. So that I would educate the male brethren by beating them at their own game, in part. But I would do more than that. I would try to appeal to their intellect. In my odd moments, when I have nothing to do, else to do, I reflect and brood over an American society in which the average life expectancy of women in the United States is 6 to 7 years longer than men. And this is a very sad and drab prospect of a society of aging, widowed, lonely women. And I say to myself, very seriously, without any jokes about who's the weaker sex or who's the stronger sex, what is happening in our society that men are being killed off 6 or 7 years younger than the women, leaving this tragic situation of older women aging without men? I happen to believe in a coeducational society. And so for me, this is a tragedy. And I say to myself that America is a competitive society, and Harvard, heavens knows,
is sort of par excellence of the symbol of competitiveness for prestige and power. But I'm wondering if, instead of taking guns and shooting ourselves down, if we are not killing ourselves off by having overemphasized competitiveness, getting ahead, organization man, reaching the top, etc. The women, many of them, in their submerged position, have not been exposed to this. And while I'm no scientist and cannot say, it just seems to me ordinary common sense that part of what is back of heart attacks and strokes and the kinds of diseases that are taking men away from here sooner than they should be going indicates and is symptomatic of some of the pressures of the kind of competitive society in which one group, by and large, shares or maintains the power exclusively. Now, I would be willing to trade the life expectancy of women for a sharing of power that would mean human beings generally, all things considered, would be moving off the scene at relatively the same time. And I say this in all seriousness. I think it is a serious problem.
It is now 10:20. I think that last point of Miss Murray's is a point on which all persons of goodwill and even a good many of bad will could agree. I think what you've heard is a rather remarkable demonstration of the fact that there is genuine concern about this problem and intense concern, at least on the part of a small number. From them, I am certain more will be heard in the future. I have no doubt of that. But at the moment, I don't get the sense that they are really very much agreed with respect to the precise character of the problem or what should be done about it in the sense of still having some doubts among themselves as to where the emphasis should be. I'm afraid that so long as women remain a house divided, the men will continue to say, dare we not discriminate? That is not something that leaves me very happy. Good night.